Okay, let's unpack this. We are about to dive deep into a career that was, frankly, impossible for its time.
Truly.
When we look back at the 18th century, the doors of academic institutions were not just closed to women, they were double bolted. Yet we have a woman who didn't just get a degree. She became a world-renowned physicist, a salaried academic, and a European intellectual celebrity.
Indeed. Our deep dive today is into the life and work of Laura Maria Caterina Bassi Varati, born in Bologna in 1711.
Quite a name.
It is. And we're using her biography, which is sourced from some really rich historical accounts, as a singular case study.
Right.
We want to understand the almost unfathomable strategic, intellectual, and frankly, political maneuvering it took for a woman to establish and then sustain a lifelong professional scientific career.
And not just any era, but during the Enlightenment.
Exactly.
And when we talk about this being a lifelong professional career, the source material immediately hits you with a list of global firsts that just redefine what you thought was possible in the early 1700s. The central aha moment here is how revolutionary her institutional standing was. She was the first woman in the world to hold a salaried university professorship. She was the first woman to earn a science doctorate. And not only was she paid, but if you look at the university ledger at one point, she was actually the single highest paid employee at the University of Bologna.
That part is just staggering.
It's astonishing when you consider the pervasive institutional resistance to women in public life.
It's a fact that demands attention. I mean, to truly grasp the rarity of this achievement, you have to look back slightly further. She was the second woman globally to earn a Doctor of Philosophy degree.
The second, okay, after who?
After Elena Cornaro Piscopia, who received hers way back in 1678.
So there's a huge gap.
A 54-year gap. Think about that. It took over half a century for another woman to break that barrier.
Wow.
It just underscores how significant Bassi's success was and how incredibly slow institutional progress remained. Her accomplishments were so universally celebrated at the time that she was widely recognized and, frequently depicted as Minerva.
The Roman goddess of wisdom.
Exactly.
That public branding, the visual representation of her as the Bolognese Minerva, is so crucial. It perfectly captures that blend of her intellectual gravitas and her local, almost civic fame.
It does. She wasn't just a scholar. She was a national treasure that Bologna and the Papal States could, promote to the rest of Europe.
A symbol of progress.
An embodiment of enlightened progress, which Bologna, a conservative historic university city under the control of the Papal States, was surprisingly eager to project.
That's a key point. You have to remember this political context. Bologna was not a liberal city.
Not at all. But it was a city of immense historical academic prestige, which makes her achievement even more unlikely.
So let's nail down the foundational biographical data from our sources before we dive into her education. She was born on October 29, 1711, in Bologna.
Which was then part of the Papal States.
And her family background certainly provided a critical advantage. Her father, Giuseppe Bassi, was a prosperous lawyer, and her mother was Maria Rosa Sassori.
That prosperity and social standing were absolutely essential. It meant she was guaranteed access to the best education money could buy.
Even if that education had to happen privately, outside the walls of the institutions she would later conquer.
Exactly. Her fields of expertise were incredibly broad, spanning physics, philosophy, and mathematics. And she dedicated her entire intellectual life to the University of Bologna, navigating its conservative structure until her death on February 20, 1778, at the age of 66.
So she had the means and the location. Now let's get into the education itself, because if you want to understand how a woman becomes a world-class academic in the 18th century, you have to look at the massive workaround required, which was her private education.
Yeah, we can't overstate the unconventional nature of her training. She was completely excluded from formal schooling and university lectures.
That was just the default reality for women at the time.
It was. Instead, she was privately tutored from the very young age of 5 until she was 20. This model of intensive private instruction was the only mechanism available for a girl to acquire the kind of specialized knowledge necessary for academic life.
And the specifics of who taught her and what they taught reveal a deliberate, structured plan to create a professional scholar. The first mentor was her own cousin, a father Lorenzo Stigani.
Right. And starting at age 5, he focused on three core areas: Latin, French, and mathematics.
The emphasis on Latin here is the single most important detail of her early education, isn't it?
It's everything. Stigani didn't just teach her to read Latin, which was, you know, a common accomplishment for educated upper-class women.
Right, a polite skill.
This was different. He taught her to speak, write, and debate in Latin. This wasn't a classical accomplishment. This was the professional language of European academia, of science, of the church.
It was her passport.
The ultimate professional unlock. By mastering Latin as a functional professional language, she immediately armed herself with the essential credential needed to lecture and publish on equal footing with any male scholar in Europe.
Right. She wasn't being trained as an erudite wife. She was being trained as a public intellectual.
Exactly. And the instruction ramped up significantly when she was about 13, when she began studying under a man named Gaetano Tacconi.
And who was he?
Tacconi was a formidable figure. He was the family physician and also a professor of medicine at the University of Bologna.
So a serious academic himself.
Very serious. From age 13 to 20, he instructed her in the heavy philosophical and scientific disciplines, philosophy, metaphysics, logic, and natural philosophy. He was essentially preparing her for the doctoral examination she could not formally attend.
This Tacconi-Bassi period is where the narrative tension really builds, because even with private tutoring, we see her making intellectual choices that clash with her traditional mentor.
Yes, the source material highlights that Bassi began to drift away from Tacconi's preferred teachings.
Because she became passionately interested in the emerging radical field of Newtonian science.
That choice was critical, and it wasn't just a matter of intellectual preference. It was highly strategic and, frankly, politically risky.
How so? What was Tacconi teaching?
Tacconi preferred the older, more established Cartesian teachings. In the early 18th century, the Cartesian system, you know, based on deductive reasoning, a theory of vortices.
Right, avoiding that spooky action at a distance.
Exactly. That was considered safer and more acceptable, especially in the Catholic papal states, where the church had a massive influence on the curriculum.
So why was Newtonianism so controversial, particularly in Italy?
The Newtonian system was revolutionary. It relied on empirical evidence, on calculus, and most controversially, on Newton's theory of universal gravitation, which implied forces acting across vast distances without immediate physical contact.
Which sounded a lot like magic to some people.
To traditionalists, and for a church-controlled environment, this sounded dangerously close to occult forces, or, at best, it challenged established Aristotelian and scholastic doctrine. By embracing Newtonian physics, Bassi signaled that she was not just erudite, she was on the cutting edge of modern European science.
Which gave her immense intellectual authority, but it also meant she needed serious political cover.
She did, and that political cover arrived in the form of a man who would soon be known globally, Prospero Lorenzini Lambertini.
The Archbishop of Bologna at the time.
The Archbishop, who was the one who noticed her profound intellect and essentially adopted her academic career. He became her official patron.
Lambertini's role is the single most important external factor in her early career, it seems.
Absolutely. He didn't just support her. He leveraged the full weight of the church's political power to ensure her success. He recognized that Bassi was a brilliant asset who could elevate Bologna's reputation internationally.
And his primary tool for establishing her legitimacy was to turn her doctoral defense into a massive, organized public spectacle.
Right. He essentially bypassed the university's internal resistance by making her success a foregone civic conclusion.
How did he do that?
He arranged for a public debate, not a private examination, where Bassi had to defend her work against four established, prestigious professors from the University of Bologna.
Big names.
Oh, yeah. Respected figures like Gabriele Manfredi and Francesco Maria Zanotti. This was a gladiatorial contest of intellect designed for maximum visibility.
Imagine the scene. It took place on April 17, 1732. Bassi, still only 20 years old, stood up to publicly defend her 49 theses on Philosophica Studia at the Sala degli Anziani of the Palazzo Pubblico.
And the sources emphasize the monumental scale of the audience. This wasn't just a faculty event.
Who was there?
The hall was packed with the highest echelons of Bolognese society. The entire university faculty, students, the principal political and religious figures of the city, the papal legate, the archbishop himself, the senators, magistrates.
And the source also mentions the socialites.
Critically, yes. All the ladies of Bologna and all the nobility. It was designed to create such massive social pressure that the university could not refuse her the degree. It was less an examination and more a coronation.
It sounds absolutely electric. A 20-year-old woman debating established male professors in Latin under the gaze of the future Pope.
And she succeeded brilliantly.
So what was the immediate result of this successful performance?
The result was overwhelming institutional capitulation. Less than a month later, on May 12, 1732, she was officially awarded her doctoral degree by the University of Bologna.
Which made her the first woman to receive a science doctorate, solidifying her legendary status.
Right. But the honors started even before the doctorate itself. On March 20, 1732, before the defense, she was elected to the Academy of Sciences of the Institute of Bologna.
So she was already in the club.
The first female member of any major scientific establishment, all by age 21.
So she had the title, the social fame, the institutional backing from the highest levels of the church, and now the degree. But this is where the romantic narrative ends and the gritty reality of institutional constraints begins.
Exactly.
Getting the degree was a political achievement. Securing a salary and a permanent teaching position was a different, far more complicated professional battle.
This transition is where we see the true nature of the resistance. The university was forced to acknowledge her brilliance, but they certainly weren't prepared to grant her equal professional footing.
And Bassi understood that. She wasn't content to rest on the degree. The sources tell us that shortly after the first defense, she went back for more.
She did. On June 27, 1732, she performed a second defense, explicitly designed as a petition to the Senate for a teaching role.
This was a purely strategic move.
Completely. She didn't just cover philosophy. She tackled 12 additional theses that span the entire gamut of applied science. Chemistry, physics, hydraulics, mathematics, mechanics, and techniques.
She was showing her range.
It was a comprehensive demonstration designed to prove she wasn't just a philosopher, but a practical, working scientist ready to teach.
And this demonstration worked.
It did. On October 29, 1732, her candidacy was approved, and by December, she was appointed professor of natural philosophy. This made her the world's first salaried woman lecturer, a monumental title.
But there's a huge caveat here. Our sources clarify that this position was equivalent to an honorary post.
That caveat is the heart of the institutional compromise. The university could boast they employed the brilliant Minerva, but they controlled her exposure. Her first formal lecture, De aqua corpore naturali elemento aliorum corporum parte universi.
Water is a natural element of all other bodies.
Right. That confirmed her status, but the administration immediately restricted her duties.
What were those restrictions? What did that honorary post actually mean in terms of her daily work life?
Well, the major constraint was explicit. The university prohibited her from teaching all male classes.
So she's a professor who can't teach the students.
Basically, it was a clear reflection of the deeply entrenched social expectation that even an internationally famous woman must maintain a private, modest life. She could be a symbol, but she could not be an integrated part of the daily, gritty academic structure.
She was, as you put it earlier, placed in a symbolic cage.
A gilded one, but a cage nonetheless.
So they were paying the highest salary in the institution to someone they essentially put on institutional house arrest. That sounds less like pioneering and more like pure political theater. How did she, as a serious scientist, justify accepting that?
She accepted it because it secured the crucial professional foundation. The salary and the official title was a foot in the door.
Okay.
Furthermore, the constraint had a flip side. She was a political and civic figure, and that required certain public appearances that were less about science and more about legitimizing the university's progressive image.
The sources bring up the perfect example of this symbolic duty. The annual Carnival Anatomy.
The Carnival Anatomy. For listeners who aren't familiar, this was a massive public dissection, a theatrical event held during carnival season.
Not for the faint of heart.
No. These were high-status spectacles attended by the university faculty, students, and, crucially, foreigners and members of the local nobility. Bassi was expected to attend this gruesome, highly public event every year.
And she did.
She did, starting in 1734.
That contrast is just so striking. A woman who is prohibited from teaching a classroom of men is required to sit in full view of society at an event dedicated to the public carving of a human body.
It reinforces the idea that her presence was the political point, not her pedagogical contribution. Her attendance validated the university's modernity, even while her teaching life remained shackled.
So the consequence of this symbolic role was a severe limitation on her formal academic output.
A very severe limitation. The source material notes that from 1746 to 1777, she gave only one formal dissertation per year to the university.
Just one a year.
One. And while she delivered at least 31 dissertations in total throughout her career on topics from gravity to electricity, the formal public platform remained severely restricted.
This means that if she was to have a serious, sustained career in experimental physics, a field that requires daily, dedicated work, she needed to find a way to operate outside that symbolic cage.
Which brings us to her personal life.
The answer, as is so often the case in this story, lay in her personal life and external patronage.
Her personal life proved to be her key to scientific freedom. In 1738, she married Giuseppe Verratti, who was himself a lecturer in anatomy.
And this marriage was not a withdrawal from academia.
No, it was a strategic alliance. The sources suggest they shared a sophisticated, collaborative working relationship, which strongly inspired her shift toward hands-on experimental physics.
But that must have been incredibly difficult to manage given the societal expectation. She had a massive family while juggling an academic career.
Absolutely. The sources list 8 children recorded in baptismal records, and some reports cite up to 12.
12 children.
With 5 surviving infancy. Giovanni, Ciro, Caterina, who became a nun, Giacomo, and Paolo. And significantly, Paolo followed his mother into academia as a professor of experimental physics.
Wow.
But this frequent cycle of pregnancy and childbirth certainly complicated her administrative duties and is directly cited as one reason for her limited, formal, published output.
But the marriage was the foundation for her professional workaround. How did she turn a domestic necessity, her home, into a professional opportunity?
This is where Pope Benedict XIV intervenes again, proving his political commitment to her success was unwavering.
He's still in the picture.
Very much so. In 1740, the Pope helped her gain explicit permission to start private classes and conduct experiments at her home. This move was revolutionary.
Why was the Pope's intervention necessary just to teach classes at home?
Because for a married woman of her social standing, the papal states, the home was strictly considered the domestic sphere. Turning it into a lecture hall and a working laboratory was fundamentally challenging the norms of gender and profession.
He had to give it his blessing.
The Pope used his supreme religious and political authority to legitimize this domestic space as a professional one. It allowed her to bypass the university's explicit constraint against teaching all male classes on campus.
And this private lab let her explore new cutting-edge ideas.
Ideas that the conservative university curriculum had not yet formalized. Later, in 1759, funds were even granted specifically for these home experiments, proving the official legitimacy of her private science.
So the place where her life was supposed to be most constrained, the home and family, actually became the site of her greatest academic freedom and most rigorous research.
It's the ultimate example of leveraging a paradox. The private laboratory became her true intellectual center.
A place where she could control the curriculum, focus on the latest trends, and operate without the suffocating symbolic expectations of the Palazzo Pubblico.
Precisely.
This brings us naturally into the core scientific work she was doing within those walls. What exactly was she teaching and experimenting on in her private lab?
Her focus was firmly fixed on the intellectual revolution happening in Northern Europe, specifically the work of Isaac Newton.
Right, the controversial stuff.
The sources are definitive. Bassi became the single most important popularizer and teacher of Newtonian mechanics in Italy.
How long did she maintain that focus?
For a remarkable 28 years, she taught courses on Newtonian subjects.
28 years.
Considering the institutional inertia and the ongoing theological discomfort with Newtonianism in parts of Italy, this long tenure of teaching radical modern physics was itself a groundbreaking achievement. She was effectively forcing the Italian academic world to catch up.
One private lecture at a time.
Exactly.
And this wasn't just theoretical instruction. She was fundamentally an experimental physicist.
She was indeed. She conducted experiments across the entire spectrum of physics with a particular emphasis on the emerging field of electricity. Specifically, the sources mention her extensive work on Franklinian electricity.
So the work of Benjamin Franklin.
That's right. The research spurred by his discoveries about positive and negative charges, lightning rods, and stored electrical energy, like the Leyden jar.
That makes sense. Electricity was the hot new field in the mid-18th century, and it required hands-on experimentation.
It did. And her husband was involved in this electrical research, wasn't he?
They collaborated extensively. In the 1760s, she and Giuseppe Verratti worked as a highly functional research team on Franklinian electricity.
A scientific power couple.
You could say that. Their joint research became so prominent that it attracted major European scientific figures like Abbé Nollet to Bologna specifically to study electrical phenomena with them.
So their private lab was a mandatory stop on the scientific grand tour of Italy.
It seems so. So despite all the constraints, she was producing science recognized internationally. Now, let's revisit that output puzzle. She authored 28 papers, primarily on physics and hydraulics, yet only published 4 during her lifetime.
Yeah, if she was so highly recognized, why the low publication rate?
It was a confluence of factors tied directly to her gendered existence. We've already discussed the administrative burden of her official symbolic role and the constant interruptions of family life.
The frequent diseases and complications associated with childbirth.
Right. The reality was that formal publication required immense focus, time, and freedom from domestic and civic duties, luxury she simply didn't possess in the same measure as her male colleagues.
This low formal output makes the next point even more paradoxical, her financial status.
It really does. The sources state unequivocally that she and a colleague, Domenico Galeazzi, were paid the highest salaries, 1,200 lire, in the entire university.
A powerful symbolic statement. But how much freedom did that salary actually buy her?
Very little, unfortunately, when it came to advanced research. While 1,200 lire was a massive symbolic wage that cemented her status, it was a salary focused on her person, not on the requirements of cutting-edge experimental science.
She continually struggled for resources.
Mate, the highest salary in the university wasn't enough to run a lab.
That tells you so much about where 18th century research funding was prioritized. On people, not on apparatus and materials.
It highlights a profound institutional gap. Experimental physics, particularly the kind of electrical research she was doing, required continuous investment in specialized equipment, glassware, and materials.
And we have her own words detailing this frustration.
We do. In a 1755 letter to Flamino Scarselli, she lamented, "As for my physical experiments, I am almost in despair."
Wow.
She said it was due to the continuous expenses that required assistance if she was going to advance and perfect them. The university paid the symbol well, but they did not adequately fund the science.
That personal quote really brings home the emotional toll of trying to conduct world-class science under financial strain.
It does. But to give the listener concrete proof of her successful work, let's list the 4 published works that did make it into print.
They all appeared in the prestigious commentaries of the Bologna Institute and the Academy of Arts and Sciences.
And they show a clear, sustained focus on applied dynamics. In 1745, she published De Aeris Compressione.
Concerning air pressure.
Then, in 1757, she had 2 published works, De Problemae Quodam Hydrometrico and De Problemae Quodam Mechanico.
So, problems in hydrometrics and mechanics.
And finally, demonstrating the depth of her collaboration with her husband, the Immixta Fluidis Aere.
Concerning intermixed gaseous fluid.
Was published posthumously in 1792.
So, while the publication volume was low, the quality and the focus on modern applied physics were exceptionally high.
Which takes us into the next phase of her career, where we see how she used her scientific prestige to gain even greater political leverage.
Proving how crucial her powerful network was for survival. Bassi's career was a constant negotiation, and the strongest bargaining chip she held, besides her own intellect, was the sustained support of her ultimate patron, Cardinal Lambertini.
Who, of course, became Pope Benedict XIV.
Right. And his intervention remained continually critical. The source material stresses that the Pope consistently supported her and was ready to intervene when other members of the academic establishment.
People who were likely frustrated by her salary and public status.
Right. They tried to segregate her or diminish her professional role, and he would step in. She knew where the true political power lay, and she leveraged that connection expertly against the University Senate.
We see that political leverage reach a peak moment in 1745 with the establishment of the Benedettini.
Yes. In 1745, the Pope, Benedict XIV, established this extremely elite group of 25 scholars, naming them after himself. It was the inner circle of the Bologna Institute of Sciences.
A very exclusive club.
And Bassi recognized that being part of this group would provide indispensable institutional protection and permanent prestige.
And she successfully fought her way in, which is a major victory in itself.
A massive, hard-won victory. She pressed hard for admission and was successful, becoming the only woman appointed.
But even here, we see the enduring constraints of the era.
We do. She was appointed as an additional member, and critically, she was admitted without the voting rights that all the male members possessed.
So it's that classic example of being given status without full power.
She was allowed into the room, but her voice was muted.
That nuanced achievement speaks volumes about her tenacity. But her reputation extended far beyond Bologna, thanks to her extensive correspondence. She was part of a pan-European intellectual dialogue.
Absolutely. Her influence was truly European, as evidenced by the sheer breadth of her correspondence. We are talking about letters exchanged with the titans of the Enlightenment.
Like who?
Voltaire, the philosopher and writer. Cesare Beccaria, the penologist. Francesco Algarotti, the intellectual popularizer. Roger Boscovich, the polymath. Lazzaro Spallanzani, the biologist. And Alessandro Volta.
The pioneer of the electric battery.
The man himself. This correspondence proves she was a central node in the global scientific network, regardless of her limited formal teaching schedule.
And the endorsement from Voltaire is just astounding.
It's perhaps the highest possible literary praise she could have received. Voltaire wrote to her, stating that he would be happier to be added to her Academy of Bologna than to the English Academy.
Wow.
And then he adds the barbed comment, even though it has produced a Newton.
That's not just a compliment. That's an intellectual hierarchy being established. He valued her circle over the most established institution in Europe.
He was recognizing that scientific progress wasn't confined to London or Paris. It was happening right there in Bologna, thanks to Bassi.
We should also touch on the literary recognition.
Right. Francesco Algarotti, known for his work Newtonianismo per le dame, or Newtonism for ladies, wrote several poems specifically celebrating her degree ceremonies.
So she was a cultural figure as much as a scientific one.
She was deeply integrated into the popular intellectual culture of the time. Plus, the sources confirm her own intellectual reach. She was well acquainted with classical, French, and Italian literature, allowing her to engage with these powerful figures on multiple levels.
So she had built the ultimate fortress of political patronage and intellectual renown. But the final, most satisfying victory had yet to come.
Breaking through the institutional ceiling to achieve the full, unconstrained professorship she deserved.
That victory came late, but it was total. In 1772, Paolo Balbi, the professor of experimental physics, died unexpectedly.
Bassi immediately saw the opening. Her husband, Giuseppe Verratti, had served as Balbi's longtime assistant.
So the natural assumption was that Verratti would take the chair.
It was. But Bassi was the world-renowned physicist. She had been teaching Newtonianism privately for decades. She recognized that her time had come.
After years of symbolic roles and restricted duties,
she pressed hard for the full formal position, and she succeeded. In 1776, at the age of 65, she was finally appointed to the chair of experimental physics by the Bologna Institute of Sciences.
This is a monumental breakthrough. Not just a professor, but the head of the experimental physics department.
The very field she had pioneered in her private home for decades. And the poetic reversal is complete.
How so?
Her husband, Giuseppe Verratti, was appointed to serve as her teaching assistant in that department.
Wow.
For decades, he had facilitated her work. Now she was officially his superior. A final public acknowledgement of her true academic leadership.
She held that full professional status for 2 years, until her death on February 20, 1778, at the age of 66.
A bittersweet moment, considering how long it took her to get that full chair.
It is. The sources indicate her deteriorating health was a significant factor, attributed, sadly, to the complications arising from her many pregnancies and childbirths.
Her death was recorded as attacco di petto. Likely a heart attack.
And her burial location underscores that final victory and her undeniable status among scientific pioneers.
She was interred at the Church of Corpus Domini in Bologna, placed directly in front of the tomb of her fellow scientific giant, Luigi Galvani.
The discoverer of bioelectricity.
She rests among equals, cementing her place in the history of Italian science.
A career that started with a public spectacle and ended with her placement in an exclusive club of scientific masters. Now, let's look at the enduring footprint of that career. What immediate and lasting honors followed her death?
The recognition began right after her first public classes, acknowledging her revolutionary status. The sources detail a bronze medal awarded to her by the painter Domenico Maria Fratta and the engraver Antonio Lazzari.
What was it for?
To celebrate her status as a pubblica docente e collegiata, a public lecturer and collegiate member.
And the inscription on that medal is where the legend truly takes shape.
It is. The medal featured her image on one side and the Latin phrase, soli qui fas vidisse Minervam, on the other, which translates as, only you can see Minerva. It's an explicit, immediate, and high-status acknowledgement that she was the living embodiment of wisdom, not just a scholar, but a force of nature.
After her death, the institution that had tried so hard to constrain her finally acknowledged her stature without reservation.
A large marble statue was placed in her memory above the nautical room in the institute, This ensures her physical presence remained within the university walls.
And she was a member of other institutions, too.
Oh, the sheer scale of her institutional connection is impressive.
Yeah.
She was a member of over a dozen literary and scientific academies across Italy. She permeated the intellectual establishment.
It's clear she successfully crossed the boundary between science, philosophy, and literature. But let's jump forward 3 centuries. How is her pioneering status recognized in the modern world?
Her influence has literally transcended the terrestrial sphere. The International Astronomical Union named a 31-kilometer crater on Venus in her honor.
A permanent place in the solar system for the Bolognese Minerva.
Exactly. And closer to home, in Bologna, a high school and a street via Laura Bassi-Varadi bear her name.
And her academic spirit lives on, inspiring new generations who are fighting similar battles for equity in science.
Right. The Editing Press offers a Laura Bassi Scholarship, awarded 3 times a year since 2018 to junior academics, master's, and doctoral candidates. It's a very targeted way of ensuring her legacy directly supports those following in her footsteps.
Perhaps the most visible and practical modern honor, however, is related to her work as a physicist. Her name is now attached to exploration in the most extreme environments on Earth.
Yes, the research vessel. In 2019, the RRS Ernest Shackleton, a British Antarctic Survey icebreaker, was acquired by Italy and renamed Laura Bassi.
An icebreaker.
It is now the flagship vessel used for the Italian National Antarctic Research Program. This ship, which conducts high-latitude research, is an incredibly prestigious symbol of Italian scientific exploration.
An 18th-century physicist is now lending her name to an icebreaker tackling extreme polar research. That's a powerful connection.
And finally, she received the ultimate modern cultural acknowledgement, being featured as a Google Doodle,
which celebrated her life and achievements on April 17, 2021.
That date, April 17, is significant, of course. The anniversary of her monumental public doctoral defense in 1732. It shows that even today, the historical world is drawn back to that traumatic moment.
So what does this entire deep dive into the life of Laura Bassi teach us? If we have to distill the essence of her contribution, it boils down to her ability to turn her intellectual skill into a sustainable, lifelong career, despite the almost insurmountable resistance she faced.
Now, that sustainability is the key. She possessed the political savvy, the relentless intellectual firepower, and the persistent high-level patronage required to essentially force the university to create and maintain a permanent place for her.
She wasn't an anomaly that disappeared. She was the foundation for future change.
She was the first salaried female professor because she was strategically brilliant about the politics of academic life.
And we must revisit that central paradox that defined her entire career. She constantly navigated the profound tension between being the public symbol, the Bolognese Minerva paraded at events, and the private constraints placed on her as a married woman.
Her true genius lay in how she managed to exploit that tension. By accepting the symbolic cage of the honorary post, she secured the salary. But by leveraging the Pope's authority, she used the supposedly restrictive private sphere, her home, to create a center of public scientific excellence.
Her private lab became the site where she conducted the actual cutting-edge experimental work on topics like Franklinian electricity.
Bypassing the restrictive, conservative, official curriculum.
She proved that the most important scientific advancements sometimes happen where the institution isn't looking. It's a truly remarkable story. And as we wrap up this deep dive, we want to leave you with one final provocative thought that draws directly on the source material we examined.
Consider this. Bassi's official formal publications were famously few, only 4 printed works in her lifetime.
Right.
Yet her massive correspondence network and the high praise she received suggest her scientific influence was absolutely massive. We have the quote from Voltaire stating that he would rather join her informal circle than the most powerful academy in Europe, the one that produced Newton.
Which is an incredible statement.
It raises an important question for you to mull over. How much of the true scientific progress in the 18th century relied not on formalized, peer-reviewed, printed publications, which were easily restricted by institutional biases, but rather on powerful personal networks, private teaching, and dedicated correspondence?
So for pioneers like Bassi, who were systematically excluded from official publishing structures,
for them, the private network often was the engine of scientific dissemination. It encourages us to think about where and how science really happened during the Enlightenment.